Hi everyone, I'm Mark Esper. Welcome to No Spoiler Reviews, the Christmas edition podcast for movie reviews with the surprises left in. If you ever felt like you've already seen the film just by reading a review or had the story spoiled by its trailers, well then this is the podcast for you. In this month's episode, I'll be bringing you all the latest movie news and no spoiler reviews, including Christopher Nolan's Tenet, the David Bowie biopic Stardust, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor, David Fincher's Mank, and Riz Ahmed's latest starring role in Sound of Metal. And also, because it's Christmas, I'll be running down my top 10 perfect yet not so obvious Christmas movie choices, together with a new feature, a flashback from way back, where I'll be assessing both a classic movie and its documentary, in which you can also win the movie under discussion in our Blu-ray giveaway, more of which later. So with all of that, and also our seasonal rundown of what's worth streaming in our lockdown lowdown, you best strap yourselves in for a bumper festive ride. So if that's your kind of thing and you don't like knowing the ending before you start, then let's crack on with this episode's movie news. So in a shock announcement which promises to ripple all the way through next year, Warner Brothers have decided to make all of its 2021 releases available on streaming at the same time as in cinemas. Whereas studios normally make their films online available only 90 days after cinematic distribution, Warner Brothers have decided to put all of that in the bin. Available on the same day, you will soon have the choice of seeing films like Dune, Matrix 4, Suicide Squad, Godzilla vs. Kong, and many more, either at home or at the cinema. So, who's the real winner here? Well, whilst it might be painted as the audiences, the real reason for this is that the studio's nerves are shattered. Stuck with movies that nobody has been able to see since the COVID-19 pandemic started, their cash flow has died. Adding to this a now captive audience that is consuming even more online content than ever before, the temptation is growing for the studios to deliver these movies online so they can get some money, any money, into the studio's coffers. Because all the while these movies remain unseen, it's costing the studios millions of dollars in interest repayments on development loans. Now, whilst Warner Brothers may have stated that this is just a one-year-only arrangement, the real fear for cinemas is that the other studios will follow suit. Without the cachet of exclusive access, there's little reason to go to a cinema and buy overpriced popcorn and Cokes for a bigger screen experience. In studying the numbers, whilst it's clear that movie streaming is exploding, the returns via streaming are still much smaller than a conventional theatrical release. So in making this decision, it's clear that Warner Brothers are seeking to have the best of both worlds, while satisfying both the demands of their creditors and shareholders. But is this the only solution? Well, here in Germany, there seems to be a third route that has just been released and is called KinoOnDemand.com. The concept is simple. For every 5 films that you watch through their streaming platform, your favorite local cinema will receive 5 euros directly. So this way, you can still get to see great movies while supporting cinema chains which are struggling as a result of the lockdown. Because when all of this is done and COVID-19 virus has hopefully been beaten, movie lovers everywhere will still want to return to their favorite movie houses for that big screen night out. Now, whilst their movies that are on offer are mostly indie releases, this is at least a viable way forward compared to running the electrics for reduced capacity screenings. As with all things, it depends on the volume of adoption to make initiatives like this have any kind of real effect. But the principle is sound. However, in the upper echelons of the industry, the real body blows are yet to be struck. Will cinemas prioritize other movie studios over Warner's? Will the other studios follow Warner's lead? Or is more likely sit back and see how Warner's share prices fare with their synchronous releases. In the end, the cinemas depend upon movies from the studios, and at present, the studios depend upon the theatres for bigger profits. But if everyone stays home and streams, and cinemas don't open again soon, then 2021 could end up looking like a very dark year ahead for the world's movie dromes. Let's hope not. Okay, so let's now move on from the grim ghost of Christmas yet to come to the time-travelling ghosts of Christmas present in our in-depth review of Christopher Nolan's Tenet. Finally available as of December the 15th on streaming, Tenet will soon be rentable on iTunes, Xbox and many other platforms. And for a lot of people, it's a movie that many have been waiting for. Cast in the undesirable role of single-handedly saving cinema chains, we'll now find out how it performs on streaming after its summer theatrical release. But before all of that, is it any good? Well, with the notable absence of James Bond this Christmas, outside of TV reruns, this might be the high-concept spy thriller you've been waiting for. Let's check it out now with an in-depth, no-spoiler review. Tenet. Having survived a terrorist attack on a Russian opera house, John David Washington's CIA agent discovers that it was just a test of loyalty. What really lies ahead of him is a confrontation with Russian oligarch Andrei Sator, as played by Kenneth Branagh. It turns out that Sator has been bringing weapons back from the future so as to kill people in the past. So with the world at stake and a threat of a future war consuming the present, can John David Washington CIA agent save the day or be consumed by the future before it's even happened? Let's see. No stranger to huge conceptual movies and temporally thematic narratives, each movie from director Christopher Nolan feels like an ever-expanded palette of risk. With every release, he brings us something new, and in every movie, he tries to deconstruct existing cinematic conventions into new storytelling devices. So as one to never set the bar low for either himself or his audience, Tenet is his latest dense offering with explosive arthouse credentials. And much like its characters, Tenet's plot appears to take no prisoners. However, this time, if you don't initially grasp the story, it thankfully won't leave you behind like Inception did. You see, the nuts and bolts of Tenet's story are actually quite simple. Kenneth Branagh's dastardly oligarch is threatening world peace whilst also trapping his wife in a loveless relationship, and John David Washington has to save both her and the world. So, simple, yes? There's really no problem this time around. However, if you look even closer, you'll notice that this time the plot closely resembles that of another franchise which Christopher Nolan is quite often linked with, James Bond. In short, this time it's save the girl, save the world. So what you actually get with Tenet is exactly how Christopher Nolan would approach a Bond movie. Cold, brutal, unapologetic, and indifferent to concerns of humour, this is the Bond movie the Broccolis would never make, and yet possibly the closest that Nolan will ever get to making one. Are there any gadgets? Yes. Car chases? Yes. Sharp suits? Yes. Luxury product placements? Yes. Does the bad guy speak with a foreign accent? Yes. And there you have the key component, the bad guy. Because in Bond movies, they rely upon a good villain, and in Tenet, Nolan has got a great one in Kenneth Branagh's Sator. Realizing that by saying less it will result in an even greater sense of malice, Branagh's omnipotent oligarch easily trumps Hugh Laurie's turn in The Night Manager. Also from The Night Manager, Elizabeth Debicki has got herself caught up with the wrong arms dealer again, and is tasked with helping John David Washington bring about Sator's demise. However, he's not alone in this task. Robin Pattinson is here to bring a similar sense of sartorial style that Tom Hardy did in Inception, as a Brit-inflected companion who's always on hand to lend a fist. So, with the present being attacked by the future, and a motorway car chase that shows the Matrix Revolution how it should really be done, Tenet is a film that really never lets you catch your breath. With absolutely no real scenes where its characters stop, sit down, and digest what's just happened, Dolan has strapped you into a runaway vehicle to the future. Similar in many ways to Inception, the final act becomes a juggling festival of subplots, payoffs, and buried treasures brought out from the film's beginning. In the end, Tenet is a movie about characters who move backwards and forwards through time with weapons which may or may not have been developed in the future. To make it easier for you, I could describe it as Minority Report with an infinitely more labyrinthine plot, a more mature take on the themes of Terminator, minus the robots of course, or that it runs with the paranoia of a Scanner Darkly. But these are all tangential threads woven into a new fabric, because in the end, Tenet is its own beast. And so whilst you may struggle to empathise with its characters given the speed at which it's travelling, there's no question that Nolan has expanded his catalogue yet again by revisiting his favourite theme of time. And speaking of time, now it's time for our seasonal lockdown lowdown. So what are the new hits and misses Streamingland has available for you today? Well, in our usual quickfire look at new releases, forgotten favourites and other bargains, I'm now going to be checking out iTunes, Netflix and Amazon to see what treats they have under the tree for you over the next 2 weeks. Let's start with iTunes Premium Videos on Demand. In iTunes Premium VODs or Videos on Demand, those are the ones where you can expect to pay around 20-odd euros or dollars to see them upon first release, the current pick of the festive crop looks like this. Love and Monsters. Dylan O'Brien is having a bad day. Monsters have invaded the Earth, killed his family, and taken over the planet. But there's an upside. Earl lives. Alright, that's a little faux shout-out to the Walking Dead fans out there. But actor Michael Rooker is back on top survivalist form to help Dylan reconnect with his girlfriend who's 85 miles away. Will he survive? Will they get back together? And will CGI monsters go squish? Yep, pretty much. But if you want to check out from an overindulgence of turkey and stuffing, then this might do the job. Although what really needs to be stuffed and mounted, and that's on your wall, is the oh-so-tiresome stupidity of buddy games. pretty much picking up where the god-awful movie Tag left off, Buddy Games is a hungover hangover comedy where six lifelong friends compete in a bunch of escalating dares dubbed the Buddy Games. Oh, and $150,000. Bangs will crash, crashes will smash, and expect a double side order of goofy grossness to be smeared across your eyeballs. Yum. In short, I wish it could have only gone on for longer so the characters could have suffered more. But hey, there you go. What is another tune played on an even older fiddle is The Stand-In with Drew Barrymore. Twice. You see, in The Stand-In, she gets to play a spoilt actress who's ordered to do a year of rehab and instead gets her on-set stand-in to do it for her. However, when her stand-in gets out early for good behaviour, all manner of hilarity and confusion ensues, and she decides she quite likes the showbiz life. With the genie already out of this swapped identity storyline, The Stand-In is exactly what it is. A stand-in. For whichever comedy you should be watching instead. Although what is floating in outer space is the all the more serious rock biopic about David Bowie's early years, Stardust. Focusing on the years before he became Ziggy Stardust, this movie has received some mixed notices. So, let's give it an in-depth, no-spoiler review and see if Gene Genie really lives on his back or is just a starman waiting in the sky. Stardust. Although he doesn't know it, one-hit wonder David Bowie, as played by Johnny Flynn, is drowning in London. With his label left unimpressed by the man who sold the world, they decide to send him on a tour of the United States. However, when he gets there, he finds that only lone publicist Ron Oberman, as played by Marc Maron, is there to greet him. Even more underwhelming than this is the revelation that David isn't allowed to play any tour dates. But Ron still has faith. Cajoling David into the back of his family estate, they hit the road together in an attempt to make David big. However, the path to Bowie's later success won't be a straight one. As a movie awash with sepia tones throughout, director Gabriel Rangers' Stardust is David Bowie, the struggling musician way before he became David Bowie, the rock star legend. Floating through space in an affectionate nod towards Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Stargate sequence, we find David in Keir Dulé's spacesuit. However, where it comes to the meatier matter of how Bowie became Ziggy Stardust, then the film comes in for a more bumpy landing. This is because just as its lead character struggles for notoriety, Gabriel Rangers' rock biopic clearly struggles for budget. Made up of largely underfed interior studio shots and jarring stock footage, sadly the film's rusty mechanics are all there for you to see. Which is a shame, because in the first consideration of whether Johnny Flynn can sell you the idea that he's actually David Bowie, his performance improves after a stuttery start. Jenna Malone as Angie Bowie snaps and snarls at backstage girls and label execs alike, but it's actually Marc Maron's faded publicist Ron who gets most of the warmth from Stardust's script. Dragging another wannabe Brit rocker across the country, Maron's Ron starts to prize apart the Bowie that is yet to bloom. Sadly, this is all before the third act, where the movie finally jumps off into the future without a parachute. You see, the biggest complaint with Stardust is that it's not what you expect from a rock star biopic, and it's certainly not one about David Bowie. For a burgeoning talent about whom there is no shortage of anecdotal insights and humorous spinal tapisms, Stardust is more earthbound when it should be veering off into the spectacular by its end. And that could be the job of the songs. Except there aren't any. Or at least none that you would recognise. And this is where Stardust fails to impress, whereas Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocketman got a free pass. For whilst you may not have cared for the inventive retelling of their respective histories, their music carried you through, and in this movie, there's clearly no back catalogue to fall back on. Sadly for a road movie that rapidly runs out of road, there isn't much to recommend here except a hint of what might have been. So whilst Bromley's finest may have believed that space aliens don't mingle, disappointingly, Stardust Space Jam is one that curdles upon contact. Time to come down, Major Tom. Time to come down. Now, if all this festive jing-jing-jingling has set your nerves on edge, then maybe Brandon Cronenberg has the right kind of horrific sci-fi to put a chill in your stocking. You see, thanks to Jake Weiss in Germany, thanks Jake, he has written asking me to do a no-spoiler request stop on Possessor. Now, if you're a first-time listener to the show, let me explain what this is. A request stop is where you, the listener, can write into us here at No Spoiler Reviews and ask us to do an in-depth, no spoiler review on a film that you'd like to see, or maybe one where you'd just like to hear our take on it. So with your sofa cushion in front of your eyes and the popcorn bowl a safe distance from being knocked over, let's get into Possessor now and see if it'll have a creepy hold over you. Possessor. In the near future, a young woman called Holly attends a party. Seeking out a wealthy man, she inexplicably stabs him in the throat. As police arrive, she goes to take her own life, but can't. Dying in a hail of bullets, we discover that Holly wasn't in control of her actions. Instead, she was being controlled by Andrea Risborough's Tasia Voss, a corporate contract killer who is routinely implanted in other bodies so as to carry out her assassinations. She possesses both their thoughts and their controls. However, with increased exposure comes increased risk, and Tasia is starting to experience flashbacks from the people she inhabits. With its startling imagery from its very outset, director Brandon Cronenberg's second movie is nothing if not arresting. Inheriting the same lack of squeamishness as his father David, Possessor's body horror is something that you need to be ready for. Whilst its intent is not to be horrific, when it does come, you will see everything. Other tonal similarities can be found in its music. Reminding you of Howard Shore's funereal score for both Ezigstenz and Videodrome, Possessor's brass section suggests an atmosphere of increasingly sterile unease. However, for me, at its core, Possessor is a film really about relationships, and none more so than the one played out between actresses Andrea Risborough and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Risborough is Tasia Voss, the possessor, a sub-epidermal assassin who's coming apart at the seams. And yet all the while, she's being studied across the desk by Jennifer Jason Leigh's Gerda. Crumpled in a haze of brown wardrobe choices and spectacle-rimmed cigarette smoke, Gerda is the professionally friendly judge of Tasia's actions. And it's a deliciously dry performance from Jennifer Jason Leigh. So whilst the movie never obliquely states its year, the daily THX-1138-like mundanity of Tasia's latest quarry, Colin, suggests the near future. Romantically linked to Tuppence Middleton's Ava, Colin is ideally placed for Tasia to assassinate her industrialist father, as played by Sean Bean. And whilst Sean Bean gets to briefly patronise and demean Tasia as Colin, it'll be no surprise to no one as to how this casting choice is eventually going to end up. So whilst Possessor harbours thematic echoes of Christopher Nolan's Inception, with its spies moving through other people's realities, Possessor is still much more markedly the distinctive movie. Whereas the characters from Inception are all immaculately tailored as they enter other people's minds, Possessor's characters inhabit a much more tactile world. Also, whereas Inception and more recently Tenet employed mind-bendingly complex series of special effects to sell their surreal realities, director Brandon Cronenberg has gone for in-camera optical effects instead. So whilst from a budgetary standpoint, Possessor is the poorer cousin to Nolan's arthouse blockbusters, I'd argue that this film's paucity is actually a virtue, and one that brings you far closer to its characters than Tenet ever did. Hemmed in by the rules that writer-director Cronenberg has created for his world, Tasia only has a fixed amount of time in which she can stay inside her prey without becoming trapped. Also, with the binding of their bodies being a very fragile one, it needs to be regularly recalibrated so as to make the possession stick. All of which offers many interesting parameters, and Cronenberg's second feature stunningly wrings them dry as we near its conclusion. So in the end, expect questions. Many, many questions. Because in the untangling of this tale, there's going to be a lot to chew on. Whereas Tenet is a simple story complicatedly told, Possessor is a denser story, more simply told. See them both and see what you think. I think both movies can safely coexist in your movie appreciation list of 2020. But if I had to sum it up in a single sentence for a movie poster quote, it'd be this. Possessor is the movie that Tenet wanted to be. And now cue the avalanche of hate mail. It's okay, you can pull me out now. Watch the film, you'll get the quote. Right, so with Mr. Cronenberg Jr.'s hold over you temporarily broken, let me give you a quick rundown of the best and not so obvious Christmas movies you could be enjoying this year. Now, when it comes to Christmas on TV, the movies on offer are usually a compote of new releases, festive favourites and spent crackers that never deserved to be pulled in the first place. Basically, it's a mixed Santa's bag of biased family-friendly fare and cut-for-TV concessions. So, let's not do that. Or even be bound by what's on the square box in your living room. You see, with the internet, even more in our lives than ever before, there's really nothing to stop you from casting your net a little further and haul in some markedly different festive fare. So here are a few price catches I would suggest you go fishing for. For Christmas Eve, rare exports. Now, you know how it goes around this time of year, and there are a bunch of righteously high-rated movies that you always watch over the festive period. Think of It's a Wonderful Life, Die Hard 2, The Sound of Music, and so on and so on. But in the no-spoiler household, Christmas isn't Christmas unless we're watching a grisly little number called Rare Exports. A deeply frozen Finnish film that scores highly for its black humour and bending of the Santa Claus legend. Father Christmas is a beast that likes to hunt, and he knows if you've been naughty or good. Or you could plumb for our less gruesome alternative, the Grand Budapest Hotel. Now, although it's not strictly a story that takes place at Christmas, there's a bunch of snow about, and that's good enough for me. Because if your inner child likes to open their presents early, then Wes Anderson's Gingerbread House of Genteel Humor and Overmannered Slapstick is a perfect feel-good blanket to glide into Christmas Eve with. Ralph Fiennes is an unexpected comic treat as Gustav H., the hotel's dapper concierge, who knows where most of his guests' secrets are buried, mainly because he had a hand in digging the holes himself. And thereafter, the star-studded cameos just keep falling off Anderson's Christmas tree in a non-stop avalanche of joyous nonsense. Moving on to Christmas Day, and the pickings become a bit more varied. Embracing the spirit of a family get-together, then I go for 1991's The Addams Family. With Angelica Houston and Raul Julia as Morticia and Gomez Addams, and Christina Ricci stealing the show as one half of their spookily depraved kids, there's really too much to enjoy here. Christopher Lloyd's Uncle Fester has returned to the fold after being lost in the Bermuda Triangle, and everything's not quite as it seems in a rollercoaster farce that will sweep everybody up in its charms. However, if you need something a little bit more dramatic, then I might recommend a new addition to the menu in Greta Gerwig's pitch-perfect update of Little Women. With Saoirse Ronan as Jo March, a fledgling writer whose debut article for publisher Mr. Dashwood becomes a sprawling novel about her sisters in 1800s America, this really is a deft comic treat perfect for a family Christmas Day sit-down. By breathing new life into an old text, it's really fair to say that Greta Gerwig's adaptation succeeds in reflecting modern life into a much-loved classic. Moving on into the afternoon, and possibly post or pre the Queen's speech, depending on your views on the monarchy, the best movie to carry you over into tea time is A Muppet Christmas Carol. Newly restored with one of its songs now undeleted, Jim Henson's Festive Triumph is probably my favourite of the Charles Dickens adaptations. With Michael Caine holding his own against an army of felt-skinned co-stars, and slowly learning that meanness is not best served by a lump of coal, this really is the movie that has the magic that you're looking for. However, if you need a superhero vehicle to transport you into the evening, then maybe Tim Burton's Batman Returns could drop you off. Arguably an improvement upon his first Batman film, Michelle Pfeiffer steals the show as the best Catwoman on screen so far. All staples and claws, she has the catsuit to die for and the claws that will get you there. Michael Keaton excels again as Bruce Wayne, and even though he really can't turn his head as Batman, you'll forgive him from waddling about as he's joined by Danny DeVito's army of penguins. But as the turkey settles into your stomach and the charades quickly lose their appeal, then maybe you want to turn to something darker with which to see out the night. My choice? The Shining. Again, falling more into the category of there's heaps of snow about compared to the amount of tinsel on display, Stanley Kubrick's reimagining of Stephen King's novel is still a horror yardstick that few can take an axe to. With Jack Nicholson's career-best stab at schizophrenic paranoia, and Shelley Duvall hanging on for grim life, this is a cooped-up chiller that explodes with smouldering potential from its very first frame. So, you've now made it to Boxing Day. What's left to unwrap? You could settle into a Western like Dances with Wolves, or lounge into a legal drama like A Few Good Men. But there's a movie that maybe I think you should take the risk of falling asleep in front of, and that would be Eyes Wide Shut. Now, whilst I know this is a Kubrick misstep and is not to everybody's taste, I'd still argue it's an oil painting worth revisiting the more time goes on. Now that its leads are no longer married, Nicole Kidman's and Tom Cruise's taste for passive aggression is nakedly bare, and the movie contains hundreds of hidden clues and gestures, some of which pay off and some of which don't. Yet one movie that really does pay off as it trudges through the snow is Thomas Alfredson's Let the Right One In. Yes, we've arrived at our genre stop, and given the time of year, the quick descents into darkness and the rim-lit silhouettes, it has to be vampires. Not to be confused with the god-awful shot-for-shot remake for the American market that was Let Me In, Let the Right One In chronicles the nocturnal relationship of a bullied schoolboy and the strange girl who lives across the way. Subtle in ways that the American version just patently wasn't, the original Finnish version is a delicious treat and a perfect way to see the festive season out. However, if you've still got a yearning taste for razzmatazz and all that jazz, then maybe our new feature, A Flashback from Way Back, might have you covered. In a weird pairing of an original movie together with its documentary-length feature, A Flashback from Way Back is where we first assess a movie cold, and then later see if the story of its making can make a case for its reassessment. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Paul Verhoeven's Showgirls, and then afterwards, its documentary, You Don't Know Me, which examines Showgirls' cultural re-evaluation. So, let's start with Showgirls. Hitchhiking her way to Las Vegas, Naomi Malone is an angry dancer with jaded stars in her eyes. Unable to accept compliments and liable to blow a fuse at any moment, it's a wonder why anyone would gravitate towards her, and yet still they do. First in line is costume designer Molly Abrams, and later is frustrated choreographer James Smith. Yet even with them offering her a place to stay or a dream to follow, Naomi is really only after one thing, to become the lead dancer in the Stardust Casino's Goddess Review Show. However, that spot is already taken by the carnivorous Crystal Connors. Can Naomi make it to the top? Or will Crystal eat her up before she gets there? Well, let's see. Because in Showgirls, everything, and I mean everything, is dialed up to 11. Clearly embracing the mantra that if it's possible to pour sex into the most innocent of frames, Paul Verhoeven and screenwriter Joe Esterhaf have set out to do it with Showgirls. Buoyed up by the box office receipts and legs that were uncrossed by Basic Instinct, they basically wanted to go one further with a story of a stripper making it big in Las Vegas. However, this time, it needed to be more extreme, and from its very first moments, Naomi, their lead character, is frustrated, excited, vengeful, and then frustrated again. That's it. That's the complete range of emotional gears that Elizabeth Berkley gets given as Naomi. And the polarizing effect is instantaneous. You either love it or hate it. And at the time, critics hated it. Pushing directly down on America's puritanical button that says sex is verboten but violence is okay, it's fair to say that this is a movie with a hard-on for outrage. Deliberately ricocheting off its supporting cast, Naomi's one-dimensional ascent to success is defined by those around her. Whilst Gina Rivera's Molly has the most Leaving Las Vegas subplot, and Glenn Plummer's James crashes in his choreography dreams for Unplanned Parenthood, that's as real as things are allowed to get. Gina Gershon gets to be a wicked, sexually ambiguous pantomime queen, and Kyle MacLachlan is called to thrash around like a demented dolphin, and that's about where the acting ends. What is impressive, though, is the dancing. Whilst this movie is a long way from a chorus line and yet still fused to the hip of Chicago's murderous dreams of stardom, Showgirls' linear narrative best expresses itself in its dance sequences. Whereas in martial arts films, the fights gradually become almost balletic in their choreography, that murderous intent is truer here. With sharp slashing arm movements and scything leg spins, each of Naomi's routines seem to be building towards a more lethal payoff at the end. All of which sums this movie up as a kind of naked fireworks show where the only accelerant is ambition. So, was that all that Showgirls added up to? Naked bodies gyrating to a trampling of American excess? Or was there something much more deeper at play here? To answer that question, let's move on to the almost essential companion piece, You Don't Know Me, by director Jeffrey McHale. So in 1995, director Paul Verhoeven and screenwriter Joe Esterhaz followed up their smash hit Basic Instinct with Showgirls, which died a near instant death. In a head-on collision with American sensibilities, it was laughed at, derided upon, and torn apart with weighty adjectives, and the battle lines were quickly drawn up by those who either loved Showgirls or hated it. However, in Jeffrey McHale's You Don't Know Me, you will be presented with a series of different perspectives to help balance the argument. Will it change your mind, turn hate into love, or at a push deliver admiration for a failure that was far too ahead of its audience? Well, the basic fault line is then seems to be pretty clear. It's sex. Paul Verhoeven wanted to show it, and mainstream America wasn't ready for it. Whether shocking audiences with such movies as Flesh and Blood, Basic Instinct, or Starship Troopers, Verhoeven always knew how to get a reaction. However, when Showgirls arrived in 1995, his Hollywood run of form quickly ran sour. Far from being taken seriously, it was taken apart. In press, in print, and on TV, and with the usual Save America Soul Brigade taking up their banners outside participating theatres, Showgirls' infamy was duly born. And yet now in the more permissive noughties, some would argue that Showgirls is now due a proper third act of appreciation. Taken either as an intentional or unintentional comedy, Showgirls has become a film that you can laugh with rather than at. Much like 1974's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which hinges upon actress Terry McMinn's ability to scream throughout the entire movie, Showgirls' magnetism is solely charged by Elizabeth Berkley's ability to be constantly manic, contrary, or both. And herein lies the next strand of Naomi's modern appeal. Elevated into the same stratosphere of mania reserved for the likes of Isabel Adjani in Possession or Faye Dunaway in Mummy Dearest, Naomi's high-voltage antics have become cocaine-coated catnip for the drag queens of the world. Where camp is an exaggerated form of seriousness that bursts its own bubble, Naomi indeed definitely has that covered with a single toss of her first slush puppy. Is Showgirls still a mess? Yes. Was it always intended to be one? Well, that's the fun with ongoing mysteries. They can't be categorically solved, and Verhoeven, arch prankster that he is, loves still prodding his audience with every interview he gives. Did Verhoeven really manage to get Hollywood to finance a slew of 1990s blockbusters that did nothing more than lampoon American culture? I don't know, but if yes, then it's a delicious fantasy, because with this Las Vegas romp, he pretty much busted his flush. So, seen in context, You Don't Know Me certainly makes a spirited case for re-evaluation. And whether or not Verhoeven and Joe Esterhaz ever intended Showgirls to have the level of subtext that is being afforded to it, this is a mystery that looks set to continue. In seeking and duly being granted the industry's Kiss of Death certification, NC-17, Showgirls suddenly died a death at the box office. However, even with its NC-17 rating now slipping to a lowly 16, taken as a double bill, You Don't Know Me is without question the essential après-dinner amuse-bouche with which to follow Showgirls. In commendably throwing all of Showgirls' previous courses into a different context, it certainly beats brown rice and vegetables, and a whole lot more besides. So, did you enjoy that? Do you have a movie or a documentary double bill that you'd like us to cover? Then please by all means send it in. In the meantime, you can own the Blu-ray of our featured movie Showgirls as part of our new Blu-ray giveaway. All you need to do is visit the No Spoiler Reviews homepage on Facebook and leave your wittiest one-line review of Showgirls on our Blu-ray giveaway post, and then share the original post on your own feed. After the 21st of December, we'll choose the funniest entry online and mail the Blu-ray to the winner once we've got your address from you. Just a few T's and C's to cover. Sadly, we can only offer this competition to those of you listening in Europe and UK due to pandemic restrictions. Okay, so having high-kicked our way out of Showgirls, why don't we head over to Netflix now and see what festive treats they have in store for you. First up is Shazam, which is one superhero origin movie that genuinely delivers a lot of laughs outside its teaser trailer. Riffing off the setup of Tom Hanks in Big, Billy Batson is a young boy who not only becomes an adult but also a superhero when he mentions his new name, Shazam. And also with great power comes mild, goofy irresponsibility as both Billy and his foster brother Freddy learn about Shazam's powers. However, in the shadows, actor Mark Strong has a false eye, an evil grimace, and he plans to use both in this fun send-up of superhero movies. What is straining not to be over the top is Ryan Murphy's The Prom. Opening with a high school that forbids a teenager from taking her girlfriend to the prom, three fading Broadway stars take it upon themselves to give the two girls the prom night they deserve. Making up this firmament of stars is Meryl Streep, who gleefully munches her way through the dialogue, Nicole Kidman straining to be cutesy, and James Corden doing his best Nathan Lane impression. Sadly though, with the spotlight lingering a little too long on these three, the film's pacing and emphasis suffers as a whole. However, if you're not in a particularly demanding mood, and you want a new musical to fill that gleeful-sized hole in your Grinch-like heart, then this is the one that might do it. However, plunging even deeper depths of what went before is Gerard Butler and Gary Oldman in submarine thriller Hunter Killer. In short, a rogue Russian general has staged a coup, and it's the job of Gerard Butler's submarine captain to go into hostile waters and rescue him. Cue the sonar pings and fraught looks you probably remember from The Hunt for Red October and Tony Scott's Crimson Tide, because they're back again in this movie. That said, Michael Nyquist in one of his final roles gives it both barrels, and whilst this underwater game of hide-and-seek isn't really going to echo long in your memory, it may well help you get through the turkey leftovers. What shouldn't be left out of your Christmas list consideration, though, is David Fincher's new movie, Mank. A sumptuous behind-the-scenes homage to the birth of Citizen Kane, this is one production that oozes quality from its very first frame. Let's check it out now with a no-spoiler, in-depth review. Mank. In 1940s Hollywood, up-and-coming director Orson Welles has been given carte blanche by RKO Studios to develop whatever film he wants. With this in mind, he settles upon veteran screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz to write the script. Secluding Mankiewicz in Victorville, California, under the watchful eye of producer John Houseman, Welles expects great things of Mankiewicz, or Mank, as he's more commonly known. However, as well as being a gifted writer, Mank is also a functioning alcoholic, and with only 90 days in which to turn in the script of the century, no one really knows if he's going to be able to deliver, not even Mank himself. Opening in gorgeously grainy black and white, Mank is a film that is as much steeped in references as it is with reverence. Essentially the dramatised series of events that led up to the creation of Orson Welles' seminal Citizen Kane, director David Fincher layers the screen with a multitude of clues and subtle visual motifs that hint at the kind of film that Citizen Kane would eventually become. Set in the centre of the movie, though, is the performance of Gary Oldman as Mank himself. A stone that seems to be able to skip on the surface of any social pond, both character and actor are in pretty unassailable positions. Mankiewicz is revered by his peers as a touchstone writing talent, and Gary Oldman has made a career of effortlessly disappearing inside on-screen characters. Add to this also the reputation of Citizen Kane itself being a film so ridiculously far ahead of its time, and you have a prequel that Mankiewicz may well have described as being what God would have built had he had the money. Fortunately, though, Mank is not a film dependent upon a deep and thorough advanced knowledge about Citizen Kane or its infamous inspirations. What it is a film about gambling, because at its heart, both Mankiewicz and Welles are risk-takers. In thumbing their nose at the Hollywood establishment, Mank will risk everything to write about what he knows, and that's power. In doing so, the film darts backwards and forwards through time, itself aping the non-linear style of Citizen Kane. Careening from one scene to another, as if sobriety is a virtue best avoided, Oldman's Mank skewers the vanities of studio bosses and starlets alike, all the while watched on by their ringmaster, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst. Wallowing in the shadows and hooded by Charles Dance's expertly expressive eyes, both Hunter and Quarry recognise each other and yet imagine each other in vastly different roles. Mank is no threat to Hearst, and Hearst is a target too big for Mank to ignore. And so as a result, the stage is set for what becomes an interesting trial of nerves. With their bugles wheezing and their ponderous fingers tripping down a keyboard, musicians Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross beautifully light the way. With Mank's target now fully exposed to the gossiping minds of Hollywood's glitterati, Fincher moves his lovingly made prequel into high gear. Will Mankiewicz get away with it? And if so, will he receive the credit that he's due? Irrespective of whether history chooses to see whether Welles or Mankiewicz as organ grinder or monkey, Fincher delivers a witty truth that both were actually needed for what would become the takedown of the century. Okay, so as we leave 1940s Hollywood, let's head over now to Amazon Prime and find out which glittering prizes can be seen for free as part of their Prime delivery package. First up is Knives Out, a forensically fireside-like whodunit, much in the style of Agatha Christie's Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot. Knives Out is Last Jedi director Rian Johnson's radical remix of an over-familiar formula. Starting off by revealing the identity of who killed writer Harlan Thrombey, as played by an excellent Christopher Plummer, Johnson inverts your expectations as he leaves Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc to pick up the clues. However, it isn't that straightforward, and if there's a disappointment to the proceedings, it's the film's slow reversion to formula by the end. Chris Evans, Ana de Armas, Jamie Lee Curtis, Michael Shannon, Don Johnson and Toni Collette are all having a ball, and you might too as you wolf down your chocolates. But having started out so well, I'm not sure your interest will make it to the final cut. Another favourite which for me falls short of greatness is Baby Driver. In a crime caper drama centering around the getaway driving talents of Ansel Elgort's Baby, Hot Fuzz director Edgar Wright delivers a petrolhead fantasy that actually wants to be taken seriously. This is because whilst the driving and the stunts are all balletically perfect in their execution, there's really no threat beyond Kevin Spacey's crime boss Doc. Existing in a hyper-reality that fits somewhere in between the Fast and Furious franchise and the more grounded Drive, Baby Driver really never puts a foot wrong, and that's its main problem. However, what is liable to make your head crash into your hands is Nikolai R. Sell's by-the-numbers adaptation of Stephen King's The Dark Tower. Running at a paltry 95 minutes, and believe you me, you'll be glad of it, this is another franchise starter that never got off the ground. In it, Idris Elba is a mythical gunslinger on a quest to protect the Dark Tower, which holds all of reality in place. However, standing in his way is Matthew McConaughey's The Man in Black, with mucho badness on his mind. And that's really all you need to know, because that's as far as the movie gets. What gets a lot further down the road, though, is director Darius Marder's Sound of Metal. With Riz Ahmed as a heavy metal drummer who suddenly becomes deaf, this is an engrossing drama that gets better with each beat that gets missed. Let's check it out now with an in-depth, no-spoiler review. The Sound of Metal. One half of heavy metal duo Black Gammon, recovering addict Rubin has a problem. More than just being the group's drummer, he is the sober linchpin to girlfriend Lou's grip on life. However, just when he's starting to get the measure of her suicidal tendencies, his own world suddenly falls apart as he becomes deaf. Unable to cope or even communicate with the world, the two of them manage to find Rubin a retreat for deaf drug addicts. However, as a condition of Ruben staying, Lou must leave. With Lou gone, Ruben now feels lost. Is his world slipping away, or is another one waiting to find him? Only Ruben can decide. Looking pumped up and prepared for his role as a heavy metal drummer, Riz Ahmed brings his characteristic intensity to the role of Ruben. Opposite him, Olivia Clarke is a suitably fragile figure as girlfriend Lou. And yet, despite the healthy yet palatable smoothies that he makes her each morning, this is never really going to be enough in Darius Marder's Sound of Metal. With its turquoise green and cadmium yellow colour palette, a gnawing fear is never far away from Ahmed's well-meaning drummer. As shock gives way to realisation and returns as denial, Ruben's personality unravels quickly. Once his hearing starts to deteriorate, the layers of Ruben's and Lou's past are stripped away, revealing the true nature of their codependency. Later forced apart by the strict entry rules of Paul Racy's Joe, it is Lou who surprises Ruben by choosing to leave him. Disorientated and resistant to the environment he finds himself in, it is these key scenes between Ruben and Joe that have the most heft in the movie. Sensing inside Ruben an itch that just won't quit, it is Paul Racy's performance that becomes the heart of Sound of Metal. Articulate, inviting, and disappointed when he's lied to, this is later matched by the surprised and subdued arrival of Mathieu Amalric as Lou's disconnected father, who blamed Ruben for stealing Lou away in the first place. Yet the key ingredient throughout is Riz Ahmed's performance. Whereas the opening act feels a little fractured and the second one steadies itself as Ruben attempts recovery, it is Ahmed's insistent belief that he can somehow return the world to how it was that defines the Sound of Metal. Lost inside a world of jangling dissonant sounds where there once was a full range of tone, director Darius Marder's debut is commendable about how it uses audio effects to bring the audience inside the clustered world of Ruben's impaired hearing. With a bordering on documentary camera technique, Sound of Metal is a stripped-down drama that effectively uses large passages of silence to loudly get its point across. And this is where it contrasts heavily to Riz Ahmed's other musician faced with a debilitating future drama, Mogul Mowgli. Whereas Mogul Mowgli is intentionally surreal in its depiction of a rapper facing both an identity crisis and physical paralysis, I feel that Sound of Metal gently shades the two. By taking you into a different world made up of more challenging perspectives, I think it's the one that might actually live with you the longest. That said, both films feature central characters on very similar journeys, who ultimately realise that the past is a path that you can only travel once. And so for you, it needn't be a make or break decision. Take in both movies and see what you think. Okay, and so there we are. A longer than usual sleigh ride to the Yuletide, but I hope you enjoyed the journey and you found plenty of presents worth unwrapping. To recap, we review Christopher Nolan's Tenet, the David Bowie biopic Stardust, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor, David Fincher's Mank, and Riz Ahmed's latest movie, Sound of Metal, together with my top 10 perfect yet not so obvious Christmas movies, and our new Flashback from Wayback feature, where you can also win yourself a shiny new Blu-ray of Showgirls. All that, and not a single mention of Jean Reno. Okay, go on. Watch Leon. You know you want to. I mean, it's even got sleigh bells in the soundtrack, and that has to make it a Christmas movie. Until then, you can look forward to our New Year's Day episode in 2 weeks' time, where I'll be looking back at the best and worst of 2020, George Clooney's new movie, The Midnight Sky, Al Pacino in the recut version of Godfather 3 Coda, and Russell Crowe getting all unhinged in, well, Unhinged, and much, much more. So if you like what you heard and you fancy having some more no-spoiler reviews delivered to your favourite listening device, then please consider subscribing. Please tell your friends, your family, and anyone else who loves movies. Please hit the bell, smash the like, and share the podcast. It really does make a difference, and we do appreciate your support. That said, if there's a recent movie you've missed or you haven't heard us cover, then why not download some of our previous podcasts or drop us a line at info@nospoilerreviews.com so we can include it in our upcoming episodes. Until then, please keep safe, take all reasonable precautions, and I wish you all the best for a spoiler-free Christmas. Look forward to seeing you on January 1st. Merry Christmas to you all.